Blog Talk Radio.
Graham Hancock. You're listening to Earth Ancients with Cliff Dunning.
And I hope you're doing well today. We're into, supposed to be winter here in California. And I have friends on the East Coast. You guys over there out in the other side of the country are getting hammered. I mean, hammered. Minus 20, minus 30 below. I can't believe it. I remember when I went out to Boston, this is like, I'm going to say 7 years ago, and I'm a native Californian, born in Oakland. And I went out to Boston to do some business, and I brought what I thought was, you know, heavy, heavy clothing. You know, let's see, what was that? It was like a down coat. Heavier socks, hiking socks for, you know, but I had no clue about the cold out in the East Coast. Time I was in Boston, and this is like, I'm going to say the middle of February, right? About right now. It's funny. I think it was minus 3 or -4, and that's cold for me. I mean, if it's 50 degrees, it's cold for me. So I remember being so uncomfortable, I went to a store and got long johns or thermals, and I put those on, and I ended up wearing those 24/7. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I was there for a week, I wore it just all the time, in bed and walking around. I was just so cold. And I don't know. It's one of those things you have to be born into to really appreciate that kind of weather. Anyhow, I feel for you guys out there on the East Coast, from Maine all the way down to, I guess, New York and maybe some of the inland areas like, I don't know, all those states that deal with those cold fronts. Here in California, we are hoping for more rain. We thought the El Nino was going to be slamming us, and we've had about coming on 2 weeks of fairly dry weather. Gorgeous. I mean, we're having a little bit of a heat spell, too. It's been like 70 degrees average. So don't be jealous, because we're suffering from a lack of water out here. We could use some snow. So, supposed to rain next week. For those of you that caught the show with Chris Dunn, I had Chris on just to give us the perspective of an unknown ancient history of Egypt, and we talked about what he believed was the machining of not only blocks for the pyramids, blocks for the causeway around the pyramids, perhaps blocks that were used in forming the original Sphinx. But more importantly, the level of detail that went into these Ramsey II sculptures that weigh about 50 tons each. And I got a tremendous amount of response from people on Chris Dunn, and I did post some information. But I found a series of photographs from a member of Earth Ancients on our Facebook page, and I want to kind of direct you listeners to a series of photographs from a place called Elephantine Island, Egypt. And the photos that I have posted are of one of the most amazing carved boxes, stone granite boxes that I've ever seen, and that have to date are not discussed in any magazines or archaeological studies, for the simple reason that it's a stone walkway. It's a doorway with a small roof and entranceway that was part of some kind of a palace. How it got on its side, how it was moved, is anyone's guess, because it's monstrously heavy. 50 tons plus. It's about 25 tons. It's huge. But what's unique about this gallery is when you look at the cuts in the stone, the roof, the siding, the panels of this beautifully, elegantly cut entranceway, it's a doorway, it's obvious that there was some kind of cutting tool that was able to cut this pink granite with a level of precision that we don't understand. No one can date when this thing was cut, but it's tilted, pushed on its side. It's been, at one time it was covered partially, so it's got some erosion and damage on one of the side panels, but take a look at it. It is on the Earth Ancients Facebook group page. And it's a really, really cool piece. And it's one of these things that I'm sure if we had seen it when Chris Dunn was on the show, he would have said, yeah, that looks like a big sanding machine was used here, and a cutting device of some kind was used here. But how it got to where it is in this very, very ancient part of this island, Elephantine Island, is anyone's guess. So have a look at it. Hey, as a reminder, I did announce that the winner of the Graham Hancock Magicians of the Gods was Laura Davis, and she will be getting the book, so you don't need to send in any more raffle numbers, because the book has gone to her. She's from Cedar Rapids, Iowa, so again, congratulations to Laura, and the winning number, for those of you wanting to no, was 376. That was the number that that she sent in for that winning book. I do have another book. I will make another announcement probably, I want to say another week or so. But for now, just, you know, don't send any more emails in because she won. Congratulations, by the way. That's a cool book. Hey, I'm building, and I've mentioned this before, I'm going to create a membership to Earth Ancients for a number of reasons. First, the Blog Talk Radio Network has said, Cliff, we love your show. People love it. TV people, producers are talking about it. And we do work with History Channel producers. And a lot of the guests on here are hosts from History Channel, people like Scott Walter, Hutton Pulitzer wasn't a host, but he was part of it. But there's other people who have programs on the History Channel. And, of course, Ancient Aliens. We have people like Mike Barra who are on the show somewhat frequently, letting us know what's going on with Mars. But I'm going to create a membership, which is a program where we can get funding. And we want to do a series of programs each week. Now, once a week, is about as far as I can go, just because of my time. I do want to create a spotlight program on Wednesdays, which I'm still in the works of working of doing. And that's to give new authors, upcoming researchers, a chance to tell us what they've discovered and to shine light on some of these really cool discoveries. But my goal is to have a network of 3, 4, maybe even 5 different programs under the Earth Ancients banner. To do that, I need a few bucks. So I am crossing my fingers that before the end of this month, I'll be launching this this program to get members. And our artist, Curtis, has created a really, really cool design for a t-shirt, for a sweatshirt, for a cap, for all kinds of garments and merchandise. And if you donate a couple of bucks, you're going to get one of these really, really cool garments, a t-shirt, black t-shirt with a logo, just to support us. And you'll want to wear one of these t-shirts, because the logo that Curtis came up with is a real killer. It's really nice and it looks great. So stay tuned for that. It's really important that that we promote that. I want to also mention that on the Facebook page, I posted an article by the author, Dr. Barry Fell. And Dr. Barry Fell wrote a book, God, it's about 30 years old now. It's called America BC. And I posted a couple of photos of megaliths. And these are natural megaliths that average about 50 tons each. And when we think of megaliths, we think of Stonehenge. We think of the megaliths of France. And people don't understand that a lot of these Neolithic and older people, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, and beyond, also place these massive stones in specific positions. And these photographs that I placed are in Massachusetts. And I want to direct your attention to this. You can see it on Facebook, Earth Ancients group page. I posted a couple of photographs of these megaliths. And then Hugh Newman, who's been on the show, and he's an author. He wrote the Giants book, but he's also written other books. He posted a really, really cool video that he took when he was in Massachusetts. And you can see him walking around this this stone. It's in Lynn, Massachusetts. And it's a 50-ton stone, and it has 3 peg stones supporting it. And the reason I want you to look at it is this video and also these photos is that he actually discusses the work of John Burke. And if you know, I speak about John Burke all the time. He is the American scientist who passed away about 5 years ago. But he went out there with magnetometers, with other electromagnetic frequency detectors, and he scanned these stones and found that they – the stones and the what's underneath the stones under the ground amounts to electromagnetic telluric fields. So somehow, some way, I mean, the people who built this new, who placed this megalith 50-ton stone on top of pegs, stone caps, they knew that what they were placing that giant stone under was a telluric field. So check that out. It's unique because Hugh discusses the fact that there's very unusual electromagnetic properties there. People see lights at night. There are orbs all around it. People who photograph it see bolts of light in their camera lens, and they think the camera's a problem, but it turns out to be that there's a weird magnetic fields. So really, 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 really interesting. The title again, American Megaliths, Earth Ancients, Facebook, go to group page. Check it out. It's really, really cool. I mean, we keep thinking of Europe as the only place you can see these. And by the way, the term for these are dolmens. they're huge stones. They're flat on top, round on the underneath. They're kind of table-like, and underneath them are these peg stones which support it. And there's no way of knowing how old they are. I mean, it's several thousand years. So it kind of goes to the ancient America, the unknown ancient America theme that we kind of present occasionally. So Earth Ancients, Facebook. It's very, very cool. So anything having to do with Maya are a great fascination of mine. And my guest today has discovered something that most natives in the Southwest, and even natives that I've spoken to in the Yucatan, the Maya elders, are of the belief that there has been great migrations from Central America into the North American region. And my guest today is Richard Thornton, and he was first really presented to the public on Scott Walter's program, American Unearthed. And I'm going to play just the introduction here because I want you to hear how Scott introduces Richard. It's funny because when Richard started talking about his discoveries, he got slammed by Orthodox science. How dare you talk about the Maya being here? How dare? And the thing is, and I just spoke to Richard a little bit before the show, you know, none of these scientists speak to the natives, the keepers of wisdom, you know, people that are, who have an understanding of ancient culture, who have been here before the white man. And if they had, they would have heard, yes, there's many, many stories. I mean, we heard it on this program when we had Clifford Mahuti, the Zuni elder. Huge migrations of people from Central America into the Americas. So much so that they have satellite photography of these trails passing from Mexico into Arizona, New Mexico. So it makes sense that Native people from Central America would pass into Texas and up into Georgia and the Florida Keys and things like that. But this was our introduction to Richard Thornton, and I'm going to play this right now.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing good. Scott Walter.
Richard Thornton, glad to meet you.
I was visiting down at Chattahoochee National Forest.
Yes.
Tried to look at some mound structures. I'm investigating a possible connection between the Mayans and Georgia. And tried to go look at these mounds, and I was denied.
You're kidding.
No, I was denied. First of all, I take it you support this whole Mayan-Georgia connection?
Well, it's not even a theory, it's a fact. The Mayas are one of the Mexican Native American ethnic groups that became the Creek Indians.
What are some of the things that to you provide evidence of this assimilation, really, or this coming together here in Georgia from Mexico?
We have the architecture, we have the cultural traditions, the art are very similar.
Okay.
Approximately a third to a half of the words in the Itzati Creek language are either Maya or Totonac.
Okay, linguistics.
Linguistics.
So what about archaeoastronomy? They like the Mayans use with these amazing structures that align with the sun, the moon, the planets for practical and religious reasons. Is any of that going on around here?
Yes, very much so. I'm a city planner, so yeah, I'm pretty strong at it, so I can help you there.
Do you have any of this architecture?
I have drawings and photographs, yes.
Is that what they don't want me to see?
I don't know what they don't. Why? It's a massive site. I want to keep in mind, this place is a half mile square at least. It's a town.
Okay.
It has over 300 stone structures. It's like nothing else in America, really. It's been radiocarbon dated to at least 1000 AD.
What do the archaeologists think about this?
And I thought if the archaeological community would go gaga, you know, they'd be fighting over the chance to be the one to be the great discovery of all their lives. Would you believe that some professors who had never seen this track rock site, they formed a political action group to oppose anything discussion of the track rock site and it being my unit. Now, why? I don't know. Because they're like 600 miles away.
So you're asking me if I would believe that the academic community might try to shut down an investigation like this? Yes, I would. look, pal, I've lived it, okay? I was hired to investigate an artifact called the Kensington Rune Stone.
Yes, I've heard of it.
Anyhow, that is was our introduction to Richard Thornton. By the way, Richard wrote a book called Itza Maya of North America. He's a historian, he's a architect, and he's coming to us today from Georgia. Richard, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, sir.
Great to have you. That show was extremely well received, and of course, it was the introduction to Unearthed America, and I don't know how many millions of people watched it, but boy, they got a an eyeful when you were on the program. That must have been a pretty big introduction for you. It probably opened the door to all kinds of interesting inquiries.
Yes and no, but yes, it was surrealistic to be sitting up here in a cabin near Amicalola Falls in the mountains and seeing myself on television. It was, yeah, but actually, to be honest with you, the information about the program was completely blacked out in Georgia. Most people here where I live in Dahlonega are just now finding out about the program, even though it was filmed here in Dahlonega.
Why would a national television program, which is on the History Channel, be blacked out?
I don't know. I mean, it would produce millions of dollars of tourism. See, the entire program of the North American part was filmed at tourist attractions in Georgia, so it would have brought people from around the world, and then the rest of it was in Mexico. But it was a political thing, and it was the whole year before the program and afterwards somewhat surrealistic. But it's just delay factor. What's happening now is that 2-3 years later, the people in Georgia finding out what was withheld from them, you know, by the news media, and it kind of just gives me more credibility that maybe, you know, something was going on. Just as Scott said, it was something fishy going on.
Hmm. So there must be a pretty big secret or something that they don't want the general public to see. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what you discovered, when you discovered it, and kind of give us a sense of how you connect it to Maya. Now, I've read your material. I think you have a compelling evidence, but I want to hear it from you. What's your time frame for this discovery?
Most of my lifetime. To understand the whole situation, do you mind me telling me when I first heard about the Mayas being in Georgia?
Okay. We want to hear about
that. I was a sophomore in architecture at Georgia Tech. I saw an ad on the bulletin board of the architecture college that they needed a student to do an ink on mylar plastic drawing of an archaeological site for Dr. Arthur Kelly, who was one of the most famous archaeologists in the United States at that time. Mm-hmm. He was director of the department at University of Georgia. I saw it as an opportunity to meet co-eds because at the time there's only 128 girls at Georgia Tech. I have to be honest with you. That was my motive, is to meet some hot, hippie-type girls from a liberal arts school. And so the actual students doing the excavation were from Georgia State, which is another large university in downtown Atlanta. It was not too far from Tech, in fact. So I took the bus up to downtown Atlanta, and I interviewed with Dr. Kelly. And he was at the Georgia State Anthropology Department, and when I walked in, he was talking with another professor. I don't remember his name, but he was showing photographs, and he had some artifacts, and they were talking about the evidence he had of Mesoamericans being in Georgia. And he said, oh, you're an architect, so you'd be hardly interested, Richard. Come on here and listen to us. And he had most of his photographs, I think, of bowls and of figurines, and he had an actual artifact which looked like a cylindrical seal, which was very common in Mexico, where they use it to apply patterns to cloth and to tattoos. And that's the first time I heard it. I mean, that's age 19. what happened was that I did the work. Then later in June, Dr. Kelly asked me to check out where there'd been some water damage to probably a mound, and the students from the liberal arts school had been banned from the site because they were having drug parties. And I was a naval midshipman and clean cut, didn't touch drugs, and he knew he could trust me. So I went out there with a date, and while we're there, we saw someone sewing a mound with a fake artifact or somewhere else. The purpose was to discredit Dr. Kelly because the entire faculty at University of Georgia were upset about him going public about the Maya thing. Can you believe
it? What year was this? What year approximately?
This would have been 1969. I'm older than I look.
Okay.
I mean, that's the advantage of being Creek Indian. But
so you actually saw somebody?
I saw it. In fact, he was going to prison. Yes, they'd taken a hoe from the Manville site, which was a very early agricultural site on the Chattahoochee. Students who worked for the department, I know their names, but I won't tell you, and they arranged to have it planted in the mound, and then an associate, the man who planted the stone, was then going to claim that he had proof that the site was an early agricultural site. And then there was a lot of publicity in the paper, and then these same professors who were behind framing Dr. Kelly came forward and said, oh, this is a stolen thing. This Dr. Kelly's committed a crime. You know, he was framed, and this seems to be a typical thing in the archaeological profession in the Southeast. It's not that unusual to play caddy games like that. But my testimony and the lady that was with me, Susan Muse, kept Dr. Kelly from going to prison.
Wow.
Life is strange. Well, down the line, obviously we became friends, and he made it possible for me to receive a fellowship to study in Mexico, an incredible opportunity. I got to see all of the major sites in Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, you know, unbelievable opportunity for a young man. And
was this part of your thesis program, or what was
it? It was a thesis, but it was a fellowship from a foundation. I was the first recipient ever in the United States to go down there and study all the sites and document them in order to train me how to restore archaeological sites as a historic preservation architect. Okay. And my advisor was none other than Ramon Pina Chan, who was probably the most famous archaeologist in the world at that time. He was director of the National Museum. And so I was in and out of the museum. I went to places that these gringo archaeologists have never dreamed seeing in their entire life. I was in the inner sanctum of the top archaeology museum in the world. And an incredible experience. Well, I thought, you know, it would be something for the rest of my life where I could show off my Native American or Mesoamerican artifacts, you know, at parties, and that'd be end up. And I gave lectures at anthropology departments around the Southeast on Mesoamerican architecture, including some of the very same colleges that later, you know, attacked me as being, you know, a pseudo-archaeologist. They knew good and well I'd given lectures at their schools on the subject. You know, they knew I was the expert. And,
so what degree did you end up having? Did you get a degree in historic preservation of some kind, or what was your credential?
I have a professional degree in architecture and a master's in city planning, but I had that fellowship, which was postgraduate level, which, you know, they call it a specialty line, you know, like a doctor specializes in residency. It was something
that. Right.
Okay. Now, I had to write a thesis as a result of, you know, from my studies. It was actually a thesis given by Georgia Tech, not by a college down there. But, you know, it was like they do that a lot now. They have two colleges or two institutions in sharing. Well, anyway, for most of my life, it was merely a matter of me being asked to speak at universities or archaeological associations about Mesoamerican architecture. I went back to Mexico several times. We have friends in Mexico. You know, I never thought it would have any significance to me professionally until in 2003, I was approached by six members of the Muscogee Creek National Council. Now, I'm Creek. Okay, and in fact, as you probably know, I was the architect of the Trail of Tears Memorial in Moquelon.
No, I didn't know that. We'll have to talk about that. Yeah. So a Native group approached you to.
These are national councils, be the equivalent of members of Congress, you know, but mm-hmm. for the Creek Nation, approached me and said, "Richard, we've seen your work on Mexico. Could you put down your interests in Mexico and come and do research for your own people?" And so that embarked me, and I knew very little about my own heritage, I'll be honest with you. Even at the time, I was living near Etowah Mounds, but I really didn't know. I just assumed what the archaeologist said. We were, you know, ran around naked in the woods with tomahawks or something. And I knew we built mounds, but I didn't really look at them closely. So that sparked me on almost all my work for a five-year period was for the Creek Nation doing very high-level research. Mm-hmm. And first of all, I noticed, the first time I told them was that there's some real problems in these archaeological reports. They don't know your language. I said, they're saying things that are really stupid because they might be archaeologists, but they're not anthropologists. They're not studying mm-hmm. our culture. They have no clue what these place names are, what these Creek words mean. If they did, they would have very different interpretations of the artifacts.
Where were you looking at that time? Was that Georgia you were actually beginning to look? Or
Southeast.
Where were you?
They were paying me. I did a lot of things. But one of the things, they had me examining archaeological reports and giving my perspective as a Creek professional about what these things were saying. That's mm-hmm. just part of my work. I built models of towns. I did a lot of things.
What state was that? What area?
All of the Southeast, wherever the creeks were. That would be Georgia, Florida, Alabama, South Carolina, Western North Carolina, Eastern Tennessee.
No Native establishments.
Mound sites. Yeah.
These are mound sites. Okay.
Yeah, the creeks were the mound built. I mean, they were, you know, I instantly saw the connection with Mexico. And then one thing in 2006, I was doing a study for them for Etowah Mounds, which is in Cartersville, Georgia. And I noticed that the archaeologist had a plan of a house they'd unearthed. I said, "My God, that looks just like a Totonac house." And I went back and looked at my field notes from many years ago in Mexico. I said, "That's a Totonac house. What the heck?" And so I looked up the word for house in the Totonac dictionary online from the University of Mexico, and it's the same word we use for house in Creek. I said, "Oh my gosh, something's going on here." Well, I ended up started going back into them, and we've always known the Creeks came from several parts of Mexico. We know that. I don't know if the anthropologists know it, but we even know what part of Mexico they came from. Some of them actually came from South America. And so I started going through the Native American dictionaries from Mexico and started picking up more and more words. And then I realized, you know, think how many hundreds of thousands of people in North America in the past century or so have gotten degrees in anthropology, history, archaeology, linguistics, you know, mm-hmm. maybe a million people. Not one gringo academician had ever thought of picking up a Creek dictionary and picking up a Mexican dictionary and seeing the words were the same.
Well, that's the whole issue around academic blinders and why a lot of great discoveries are not from academic sides, you know, people, because they only look at things one way, which is how they're educated. It's like anything else. If you're educated to look at one thing and not to expand your vision into – I mean, this is what has been driving me nuts. When I first went down to the Yucatan and I spoke with a number of Mayan elders, they told me about a history that's in no book and that they didn't tell the Spanish because they only gave the Spanish so much information. So really, we don't have much in the way of understanding Mayan history except for the Father Landa, who basically butchered their history when he burned up all their books and stuff. So I'm not surprised
shocked. Listeners should understand is there may be 134 different types of Maya. And mm-hmm. I mean, that's what some of the people, when the archaeologists were trying to put out their propaganda here in Georgia, they didn't tell people, you know, there were Mayas who couldn't even write, and there were Mayas, you know, that built cities, and that they were physically different. The type of Mayas who mostly came to the southeast and to Oklahoma, Spiro, are called Highland Mayas, and they look like Creek Indians. We don't look anything like the Mayas with the kind of, you know, the big noses and
all the broad noses and the forehead.
Yeah, that's
so
a different
on.
Type of Maya. I have found very little evidence of them coming to the southeast. I have found one population with people with those features just north of Savannah on the Savannah River. That's the only place. Perhaps a few came in there. Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about Itzamayas, you're talking about very different people than the ones who built the big cities. They lived in the highlands, and they were the breadbasket that fed the other cities. They built massive terrace complexes identical to the ones we're finding in Georgia. And they disappeared after a volcano exploded, a caldera. And the Mexican anthropologists have always wondered what happened to them. There are very few Itzas left now. But they spoke a different language. It was more like Totonac, and, you know, it's a different people. But surely some of the anthropologists would have known that, but that was all it was all propaganda being presented to the public here, where they didn't know. I was never allowed to speak in public, whereas there was a well-funded speaking campaign by four archaeologists who were paid to go to all the civic associations and everywhere. Every time they spoke, they got headlines in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Normally,
yeah.
That paper would never even mention something like that. So, you know, it was a slam dunk propaganda, which all fell apart when Scott did his program, which proved that we were right.
Okay, well, let's keep going into the foundation of your research. So obviously, from a young person, you were introduced to theories that the Maya had been in North America.
In Mexico, they were just the way that Dr. Pena Chan presented, it was stated as fact.
Okay. I mean, so he's an authority, obviously, and he's writing
about
this. Yeah,
he's one of the greatest in the world, yes.
Okay, but, and so...
And he was half Maya, so, I mean, he would know.
Yeah, okay, and, well, this is important. So this is basically covering up evidence of a migration. And then you, as a young person, began working with him. And then what was the big aha moment? I mean, you must have seen multiple different types of artifacts. Would you say there was one day where you walked into a mound area in Georgia, Florida, or wherever, and said, okay, this is it. And now it's all making great sense. Was it sensible all the way from the beginning?
No. No, I mean, I'd have to be honest with people. What I assumed was that sometime in the future, this is what all the Creeks felt, because we know it's part of our tradition that we're part Maya. That's no big secret. So everybody assumed that sometime in the future, some archaeologist would be on a river in South Georgia or South Alabama and find more artifacts like the ones that Dr. Kelly found in the 1960s, and this time he wouldn't be fired from his position, and the public would know that these are Maya artifacts. And that's what I just assumed it was somebody else's problem. I had to make a living as an architect, and my work with archaeology generally was the early colonial period. So, yes, I was involved with archaeologists, but it was for, you know, very old historic buildings, not for mounds. But I didn't. I started discovering, about 10 years ago exactly, is when I started realizing that we had a lot of Mesoamerican words in the Creek language, and I kept on building on that. But what happened was some people did not like me, and it was rigged up. So I was evicted from my home on Christmas Eve of 2009 when I thought I was supposed to close in 2 weeks on a Fannie Mae loan. I mean, it was all a setup, and it was – I won't go into the details, but it's basically because I wouldn't go along with organized crime. But I'll just leave it at that. But I spent pretty much a year, in a tent in various parts of the Southern Highlands, and I started seeing place names and things were Maya. But again, I thought it would be down near the coast where they would actually find something that could not be done. And then in I settled into a chicken house, lived in a chicken house in 2011 in North Georgia, which actually was near the Track Rock site. And I was looking for sites for 17th century and 16th century Jewish Sephardic mining villages.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Kennedy, former director of the National Park Service, was supporting me with checks. And the idea was that when I get enough proof of the Sephardic Jews being in the highlands, we were going to write a book together. And I stumbled upon the lowest edge of the Track Rock site, and I saw these stone walls. And I assumed, ha, I found a Sephardic Jewish mining village from the 1600s, or early, you know, that period. And then I did some research on that, not knowing that was just the tip of the site, and realized I found the archaeological report, which had kind of been kept secret from 10 years before. And it said 1,018 for the radiocarbon date. And they'd only looked at three terraces.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back and then I walked aside. That's the aha moment.
So 10 years ago, you found this rock.
No, the archaeological study was commissioned by the U.S. Forest Service 10 years ago, and the public was not told about it.
Hmm.
It was just there. It was part of, and in the Chattahoochee National Forest, but the public was never known what was told what was there. There were hiking trails, but they never were told the age and that there were major stone runs there.
Well, let me just ask you this, with your knowledge, and I have the same feeling when I've traveled to the Yucatan, Central America, and you begin to get a sense of the architectural design, the engineering and craftsmanship behind the Maya buildings and their pyramid complexes. You actually stumbled upon these, and you must have seen something that made you think, okay, this is a ruin. This is a Mayan-inspired ruin. Was that what you basically tripped on?
Well, at that point, I already knew that the Creek name for that area of Georgia was Ishapa, which means place of the Itzamayas. And something else I know, Ishiti is my branch of the Creeks. Ishiti is the same word that the Itzamayas call themselves. I mean,
okay.
The Georgia Creeks call themselves Itzamaya, in other words. I mean, what else can you say? And so, but then this site, when I got to see the whole site, I was just dumbfounded. It was identical to a terrace complex I had visited in Guatemala at Lake Atitlan, absolutely identical in every detail.
Okay. Artificial foundation?
Everything. The layout, the site plan, where the temples were, where the walls, that the fact that both sites had small streams on either side coming down the mountain, about the same size site, too. But I'd already knew at that point that the Creeks call that area of Georgia the place of the Itza. I mean, so it's not like it's a no-brainer we're going to find Itza. But I did not expect to find a massive terrace complex in Georgia, no. I mean,
wow.
And then we've found 16 now. Most of them are in North Georgia. There's three in Alabama and two in South Carolina, both of all these near the Georgia line. But now, so we're looking at almost 20 sites that this was not the only site, whereas when I did the History Channel show, we thought that was the only one. Now we know it was part of a civilization.
Now, what was the area that Walters was unable to get into to look at? I guess he was trying to get into
that's
some.
That's totally illegal. They could have pressed it and sued the U.S. Forest Service. He could not be barred.
Why was he barred from getting in there? Because he had a camera crew, I guess?
Well, I don't know. They also blocked National Geo and PBS, but they allowed the Travel Channel. And you go figure. The Travel Channel is allowed to go in there, got a permit. But then they blocked three reputable networks who wanted to do serious documentaries, and they refused access. But they did not have the right to block Scott personally from the site. It was totally illegal. Mm-hmm. And, in fact, people have been going there for 200 years. It's a popular picnic location for locals. They were lying to him. I mean, if he pushed it, he just didn't know. You know, he's from Minnesota, and when they said, you know, we'll arrest you if you go there, he didn't know.
Right.
Everybody could go there.
You actually showed him in the program, that first episode, you actually showed him some of the ruins that he didn't see. Was there? It's mostly stacks of rocks, but is there any pyramid complexes in that park that
it's a built mounds that are identical to creek mounds. I mean, uh-huh. What you're saying is like, who built the White House? English, British, or French? You know, we're talking about the creeks are descendants of a multicultural ancestry. So, but the mounds that the creeks built were identical to the mounds that the Itzas built, and probably the Itzas introduced the idea of building those mounds. But the Itzas did not build pyramids and mounds at their terrace complexes. They were agricultural villages. They're very similar to Machu Picchu. And in fact, the track rock site is actually bigger than Machu Picchu. Give you the scale of.
Can I ask you, can you send some photographs? I'd like to place them on our Facebook page of some of the photographs you introduced to Scott Walter. It's really tough because the History Channel doesn't keep anything up on their website for more than a few weeks. And that program aired, 2012?
Yeah.
And so it would really be great if we could see some of these structures that were quite interesting to Scott.
The best thing is what I sent you, that, you know, they matched my computer model with the LIDAR. Didn't I send that to you?
I don't think I saw a LIDAR scan. That would be fantastic.
Well, what I sent you was a computer model. It was mostly green because the site was green of the entire track rock. I think I sent that. Didn't I send you some drawings?
I got a few drawings, but I'll go back and to the audience members. I will put these photos up on the Facebook page, Earth Ancients. I'll put it up on the international page, and I'll also put it up on group page.
What I will do is, when we finish the program, I can send you some photographs of the walls. They don't tell you much, but my computer model, you can get a better feeling of how big it is. I mean, the site is unimaginably huge. It's 800 feet high. I mean,
when did they do because LIDAR is fairly new. When did they do a scan with the LIDAR equipment?
They did it in June of 2012 when Scott refused access. Then they hired a LIDAR company to scan it. And what it was is that the archaeologists and the U.S. Forest Service said there was nothing there and that I'd made up a story about my computer model. Actually, I'd used handheld laser measuring devices. You know, I really had surveyed it. And so what Scott did was he flew the LIDAR, and the LIDAR matched exactly my computer model, which showed that I was telling the truth.
Did you ever get any kind of supporting evidence or supporting reporting by anybody in the local anthropological network?
No, completely shunned. They will not communicate with me at all, to the extent that if, like, even a college student, several times I've had them, they come up to me and they turn their head 90 degrees sideways. Real weird.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, if you show me a LIDAR and it's similar to one of the ones I've seen in, say, Central America, that's pretty good evidence that you got not only mounds, but you probably have various complexes. So we'll look forward to getting that. But let's go back to a couple of things. You have this online. You have a number of really great references to your show with Scott Walter, American Mayan Secrets. You talk about this boulder. It's called the Forcelain Petroglyph. Or petroglyph, excuse me. Can you talk a little bit about that? It's very interesting.
At the entrance to the terrace complex are these track rock petroglyphs.
Yeah.
In 2000, the U.S. Forest Service hired a South American archaeologist who specialized in African rock art to study the petroglyphs. And he knew nothing about the Creeks, nothing about the Mayas. He had never been to Mexico, and he interpreted these glyphs on the track rock as primarily being graffiti by bored Cherokee hunters. Hmm. Now, the Cherokees didn't even own that property until after 1785. They were nowhere around when this was done. And instantly I recognized Maya glyphs. I can translate. Boulder 6, I can translate. But what's really magical mystery, you know, most of the work I do is not like what the other people you interview. It's not very mysterious. It's just scientific research. But on this boulder are the glyphs in Maya for, Great Sun, Lord Kukulkan, and Kukulkan is Quetzalcoatl. On there is the royal title of the King of Tula, that started the whole Quetzalcoatl legend. And there it is. And the timing is just right, just a few years after when supposedly Quetzalcoatl sailed off into the Gulf of Mexico from the coast of Yucatan. And I have no proof, but there's some connection. Why else would someone carve that royal title on a boulder in the mountains of Georgia? But these are Maya glyphs. I mean, I have it in my book, but these are Maya glyphs, and this archaeologist from South Africa called them graffiti. He had no idea. And most everything else on those boulders are standard Creek art that you'll find at our other mound sites. He just didn't know anything about our culture.
You know, it's funny because you cite David Kaufman's work. He's a linguist, and his decipherment of certain native tribes and the mixing of a number of Maya words and language.
Choctaw, the one who did the study of Choctaw.
Pardon me?
I believe David Kaufman, didn't he study the Choctaw language?
Yeah, exactly.
No one's questioning him. In the Choctaw language has far less Maya influence than the Creeks in Georgia. That's a really strange thing too. But yes, that's the prize. I did not realize there was a Maya influence on the Choctaws, but Kaufman has proved it. So we have a widespread influence throughout much of southeastern North America.
My gut feeling is that this is an underlining ID, an identification that probably a number of scholars have picked up on, but haven't taken it to its concluding possibilities of a Maya migration, other migrations. I know in the Southwest we had a travel reporter speak of an area in New Mexico that's considered Aztec. And he believes that a lot of the landforms, the buildings are of a similar type. Obviously the raw material isn't the same, that they can build pyramids or the same kind of complexes, but the general designs are similar to those in Mexico. And I'm wondering, is this something that you found that the comparative study of the buildings is almost like, the diagrams, the engineering plans are turned over in some manner to North American natives, and they build these sites with the flavor of a Maya influence, except that they're a different people, maybe.
I don't think so, because we have Maya DNA showing up in creeks in Georgia. I'll have to give you a little history so you understand why. I'm an Ishiti Creek from eastern Georgia. Right at the end of the revolution in 1780s, there was a Tory who was the high king of the Creek Confederacy who was pro-British, and he sent Upper Creeks to attack the Ishiti Creeks living in eastern Georgia because we were pro-patriot. And at that point, my ancestors, my family members, became alienated towards the Creek Confederacy. And after that time, you know, the Creeks were forced west, but my family wasn't, because we were considered, friends of Americans. And so but generally people with an Ishiti Creek, which actually means it's a people, show up at least a trace amount of Maya DNA. And so that's about as they were here. As far as the architecture goes, the only people in the Americas who built five-sided pyramidal mounds were the Georgia Creeks and the Itzamayas in Mexico. Hmm. I mean, that they were the only. You have many, many five-sided mounds in Georgia, practically none anywhere else in North America. The only place you see five-sided mounds in Mesoamerica is where the Itzas live.
Mm-hmm.
That's very strong architectural evidence.
Okay. Yeah, that would be. Let's talk about other influences from Maya. Now, you've described the buildings, but is there any burial sites where they've found evidence of kings or queens or rulers? I'm thinking of like Pakal at Palenque, where they have this very stately pyramid, and then you walk down into his sarcophagus, his monstrous sarcophagus, and you see these jade offerings and death.
Well, we have royal burials, but let me explain something. What was going on? It was not the elite who came to North America. It was the people getting away from the elite.
Hmm.
So the Creeks did not have human sacrifice. Everything that was distasteful about Mesoamerica was left in Mesoamerica. So they did not have large-scale slavery. They did not have human sacrifice. They had a democratic, basically like a constitutional monarchy organization where the kings were elected by bicameral legislature. But we do have burials beneath mounds in which certain people have more grave offerings, but nothing of what you see in, like at Palenque. It's interesting, though, that there's been a 100% chemical match made between the Maya blue stucco at Palenque and at the Pulgite mine in Georgia. That is absolute proof.
Well, that's what I want to bring up next, is this blue pigment that is featured in a lot of murals in the Yucatan, the Maya blue. So where does it come from? Is there like a
one of the largest sources in the world, and about the only source in the Western Hemisphere, is in Georgia for itapulgite, which is the main ingredient for Maya blue, but itapulgite was also used for some of the other stuccos. It's a stabilizer that makes stucco last forever. And what the University of Minnesota did at the behest of the History Channel was compare samples of itapulgite mined in Georgia with stucco obtained from a temple in Palenque. That's all that the Mexican government would give them. I mean, they didn't want to go around taking stucco from all their sites, but there was a 100% match between Palenque and Georgia, which is interesting since Palenque was the capital of the Itzamayas.
Wow.
Now the capital was mainly occupied by those funny looking Mayas with the big noses. So they were not, but they wouldn't have been the people who would have gone to Georgia primarily. It had been the runaway slaves, the commoners, the people wanting to get away from that whole situation that would come here. And we do look like the Maya commoners. And it's the only difference between a Creek and a Highland Maya is that we're much taller. And
okay, so that's a fairly significant discovery.
You better believe it. And
hear about this more? Because if it's a comparable pigment and it's only found in Georgia, that's a big, big tip-off right there.
It was just a weird thing going on. It's hard to explain what I was going through that year. I mean, it was like the X-Files of federal law enforcement getting involved and trying to discredit Scott's show before it was ever broadcast. I mean, really, lots of federal money went in to a propaganda campaign to discredit a History Channel show, of all things.
Yeah.
And then they looked like fools when, you know, Scott presented this solid evidence like the itapulgite. So everything was blanked out here in Georgia. The people didn't know. Normally with such publicity, you would think that the state government would have pumped big advertising campaign. You know, come to Georgia, see the Mayas.
Yeah.
And they're like, not a word. Not a word. They didn't even mention the program before or after. One newspaper, the Athens Banner-Herald, happened to mention the program afterwards, just as part of a discussion of another archaeological site that also had stone walls. And he, next morning, was hit by the very angry letter from the head of public relations for the U.S. Forest Service in Atlanta, demanding that he retract the article because he was promoting false history by mentioning the track rock. That's all. He just mentioned it. It wasn't not the article was not even about track rock. It was about something else. That's the type of environment we were in here. It was like,
wow.
Yeah, I mean, it's like 1984, and on an archaeological site, mainly people don't even know about such things. You know, it's just not normally the concern of the federal government to be involved in discrediting a History Channel program.
I guess the possibilities of rewriting history is so sensitive that they had to step in and refute all this new evidence that you and others have brought to light. It sounds like quite a history of you were in college and your professor's finding this stuff and he's being blacklisted.
It was not me. It was an archaeology professor. You know, it first put the idea.
But I mean, he kind of, you befriended him, like you said, and he
yeah, but
befriended
I'm,
you.
Yeah, but it was not my idea. It was not, and it really was not a major issue of my entire. Honestly, I could care less about it. I was an and still, even when I found track rock, I was trying to get my architecture practice going. And we're still in a recession here. And you know, that was not a major. I was not. You know, it's not like a religious campaign for me to prove the Mayas came to Georgia. It never was. It doesn't produce income for me. But
tell us about the Kolomoki mounds and what you believe is a Maya influence, because I find that an interesting subject matter.
Well, I don't think Kolomoki is Maya. I think it's South American.
South American? Okay.
Yeah, most of my research the past 2 years has been the South American connection to Georgia.
Now, who would be the people that would be connected or have a close relationship?
Paina is the it's the languages of eastern Peru, not the Quechua, not the Inca, not those people, but the eastern flank of the Andes, and there's a series of cultures there that. They're almost identical to the Creeks. In fact, we share words with them too, very basic words. I'm pretty sure they came much earlier, around 200 AD. And so Kolomoki, the Swift Creek culture, is identical to what these people, the Shipibo and the Conibo and the Kashibo and the Satipo in eastern South America. And in fact, there was a Satipo Peru and there's a Satipo Georgia. I've translated the words. I've had to learn their language, but I've translated a lot of place names in the lower elevations of Georgia called the coastal plain. They're Peruvian words, not Maya. Mm-hmm. And so they came up to, and I was trying to say on the History Channel program, but they really condensed it, was that the Maya is one layer of the cake. They contributed much of the architecture we see today from the Creeks, but they were just one layer of the cake, and really what the Creek culture is a mixture of several different influences, but rejecting blood sacrifice and, you know, and slavery and kingdoms that ruled their people harshly. That's what things were rejected. They were more egalitarian society. I'm sorry to bust your bottle, but I mean, it's a very complex.
No, it's fine.
There's no doubt about it. I mean, the coastal, we have the names at the time of European contact that the French, good bless their soul, were interested in Native Americans. So from the 1500s, they wrote down the names of people, the names of towns, and some of their words they used, and they're all on the coast, they're all words from eastern Peru. And they're not Maya words, and they're not Muscogean or Creek words. So we have a blending of a lot of things.
Do you think in Georgia, Florida, wherever that? And I see this when I'm in Mexico, and you see it at a newly discovered city, and they keep finding them. The elders say there's hundreds of thousands of undiscovered ruins up and down the Mesoamerica or Yucatan specifically, which blows my mind, and I believe it, because that whole area was flattened. But do you believe that a lot of these ruins that you've discovered, if they were consolidated correctly, would form an actual rock pyramid similar to, say, Chichen Itza, or maybe not as big because they don't have limestone, but something similar to that?
No. No, we're coming to egalitarian societies. The difference is that the people here, they built mounds, and they built, actually we have some mounds that are stone veneered, but they were not ruled by tyrannical kings. They were basically constitutional monarchies. So you don't see people being enslaved to build massive monuments to great kings. On the other hand, they were much healthier here. Now, they had a good, healthy diet, and were much taller. I mean, it's very common for a Greek to be 7 feet tall. We're average a foot taller than the Caucasians. So it was a much healthier lifestyle than what. So, you know, it was more of a people friendly. Now, I'll add something, though, that is really, to me, more amazing than building a pyramid. I have proven with GIS that all of the major Greek towns, the mound towns, between around 1,000 and 1,600 were laid out on a triangular grid stretching about 360 miles across. It is a perfect grid, and in fact, I have found archaeological sites by going to intersection points between lines on that grid that no one knew about. Now, you figure that one out.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah. I mean, and also that the towns themselves are very precisely surveyed. Okmulgee National Monument is about, the main cluster is about 12 miles long of a series of mound sites and town sites. They are all aligned on that triangular grid, too. They're perfectly aligned.
Where is that located?
Okmulgee National Monument is in Macon, Georgia. There's a bill before Congress now to extend it the full length of the development, which would be a national park around 38 miles long.
Wow.
It's older than Cahokia. It was basically the first Mississippian town.
Hmm. Now, you've gone on and produced what I find is a fascinating website called People of One Fire. And I signed up for it a couple of weeks ago when I first connected with you. And it is packed full of information related to your research, the research of other people. And tell us about why you launched that and what your goal was in doing that.
Okay. In 2006, there was a new administration in the state government that decided that they wanted to have a Cherokee casino in Georgia, which probably is quite illegal for federal law, but they suddenly started changing our history. They started just erasing Creek history in Georgia, and we were the tribe of Georgia. The Cherokees just came very late. We're here for a couple of generations, and we're gone.
What do you mean erasing history? What does that mean?
They were relabeling Creek towns as Cherokee towns and making big, you know, putting out national press releases about it and a variety of things. They did some very insulting things to the leadership of the Oklahoma Creeks, just really rude stuff. So we formed an alliance of 18 professionals and professors in the Southeast to use hard scientific research to refute both what these Georgia bureaucrats were doing and also the garbage coming out of the archaeologists, you know, where they were calling Creek words ancient Cherokee words whose meanings have been lost. Literally, where they were saying that, not even picking up our dictionaries. And that's how we got started. We got credibility because we're the ones that discovered that Oxford, Alabama was excavating a mound to build a Sam's warehouse. And we're the one that tipped off the world about that. And so after then, people began to pay attention to us. And, of course, after I was on the History Channel, that gave a lot of international credibility. Mm-hmm. I got a little note from Clarence House, which is the home of His Royal Highness Prince Charles, just kind of a generic thing, congratulations on your discoveries, you know, something like that. But I said, I'm going to take advantage of this. I sent Prince Charles a letter asking for his help in finding lost documents very vital to our research, and by golly, they did.
Did they really? Were they based in the UK somewhere?
It's a very key It's called the Creek Migration Legends, and they've been missing for 280 years. And thought there's been several expeditions of Ivy League professors to go into England trying to find them. Well, he assigned his assistant private secretary, Dr. Graham Davies. He's also a famous Welsh poet, if you recognize the name. And Davies helped us. He found that the information we needed, and so last April, we found these documents had been lost in a box at Lambeth Palace since summer of 1735. We found them. With the bless their hearts, the British government paid for the cost of copying. They didn't charge me. And what we have is these migration legends that tell us where the different parts of the creeks came from. One of them says, the Ishiti says, they came from the south across the Caribbean, first lived in southern Florida, then came to Savannah, and then went up the Savannah River. So we have an actual written document that says part of the creeks came from Mesoamerica. And
wow.
I didn't have that when, I wish I'd had that when Scott interviewed me, but I, you know, that was going to be 3 years in the future when we'd find it.
Where did that document go to? You have it in your possession? Is it going to be?
I have exclusive possession of the photostats, or the, not photostats, high-resolution photographs of the original documents. The originals are still in the possession of the British government for obvious reasons. They're priceless. But they gave me, I mean, what I have is identical, very, very expensive photography where I can translate every detail, you know, and I have transcribed them into modern English so people can read it online, things like that. But it's what it also proves is that we had a written language. We've been telling our anthropologists that for 200 years we have a written language. We're not the Cherokee. We had a written alphabet or writing system when the white man arrived. And this is the absolute eyewitness proof that we did have a complete writing system in 1735. We're still trying to find the actual, all the letters, but we have eyewitnesses where these documents are translations of the Creek written documents. And So
you created this People of One Fire to begin, posting your information, posting your research, and posting other people's research, too. Now,
It was never intended to be a one-person
this,
show.
When you announced this site, you must have had quite a few people that came up out of nowhere and said, hey, I have some information for you.
That's exactly what we do. We store the information, and now, let me explain that several of our founding members are actually PhDs in anthropology who are Creeks or Choctaws. However, they have been threatened for being involved with the People on Fire, so they keep their identity secret. But they work with me from behind.
Wow.
And I, you know, for them also, I consider myself an academic person. When I do consulting work for the federal government, have been for the last 20 years, they pay me at the rate of a senior professor with a PhD. So it's really unfair to paint me as some layman. You know, I'm a very well-educated person. And,
yes. Now, this is what I want to tell our audience, though, Richard, and this is the real credit to you. This site is so well done, listeners, and I really suggest people go to this. PeopleOfOneFire.com. It's free, but it's an actual library of Native American past, but also Richard brings in linguists, and he brings in other researchers, and he documents just a tremendous amount of information. And once you register, you get I think your emails come out twice a week.
Whenever I'm mad or not. If I'm getting mad, I might be turning out one or two a day, you know.
Oh. Is that the motivation?
If there's a particular issue, I hammer the people until they give up. And that's the power. You know, you have like 20,000 people reading your article. If you criticize somebody, they're going to start paying attention to what you said.
I'm very impressed by this, Richard. I'm very impressed. And I'm going to post it on my site so people can look at it. People of the One Fire is just very well done and well illustrated. It's a just so much documentation, just amazing. And it makes me a little sad to hear the opposition. I mean, there always is going to be opposition, but there's a lot of detractors like there is with Scott Walter and his research. So it's really a really well done website. I want to
thank you very much. Let me explain that we are military people. I mean, the Creeks are warriors, and I appreciate your nice comments, but basically we consider ourselves at war, not with guns, but with the word and with the truth. And we're also a spiritual people. We're God, you know, we've always been monotheistic, and we find that one of the problems is that most of the Southeastern anthropologists are atheists. They can't understand us. I mean, they don't understand because we're spiritual people, so we view knowledge as a gift from the Master of Breath, which is our name for God. And so what I'm doing on this website is giving back what was given to me, these incredible opportunities I had as a young man. Or even, you know, when they thought I was homeless and living in a tent, I discovered a lost Maya civilization, you know. That is a gift. So I can't charge people for that, you know. So that's our philosophy of our culture and of our religion, to give back what's been given to us. And so the People of Fire will never be something that, you know, it's not a commercial site. I get no money from it. And neither does anybody else.
Based on all your research, Richard, all your work you've done, what do you want to leave people with? This website is a wonderful piece of work, and you continue to do great work and posting things. But what do you want people to realize? To me, it's obvious that the Maya were here, but is it that there were other Native cultures who migrated into North America, or what?
It's the whole story of the Creek. Very honest, as I said, we feel that it's called the spiritual path of the Creeks is a vastly superior way of life to how America is being run today, which is basically a bunch of pigs slopping at a trough. That our way of life is superior, and that even though certain elements of academia have concealed it and not described it accurately, that it's a culture, it was a civilization, we had a writing system, and that we are American. I should say it's fried chicken, but we invented fried turkey. So, I mean, much of what you eat today is Creek food. That we are homegrown alternative to the way America is growing today, and that our civilization may have not built the huge cities with the great temples, but we're also the common Joe within a Creek town lived very well. You know, it's a society that took care of everybody. And so it's more of a statement that our culture, our heritage is of significance and is worthy of study and being respected. Does that make any sense to you?
Of course, yeah. No, of course it does.
We are a legitimate American civilization, and that there's a lot of things about Creek tradition that I think America would be a better place if they followed it. That's part of it. It's more, the Maya is just one part of it. I mean, as I said, I'm spending most of my time now looking at other aspects of cultural influence. And there's evidence that part of the Creeks were Irish, you know, from early Middle Ages, that they became one of the divisions of the Creek Confederacy.
The thing
I have a much broader interest than just the Mayas in our research.
Right. I have a huge interest in Maya. That's why I bring up the Maya.
Yeah.
The thing that is kind of a theme that has been running through this ancient America look is that this North America, the United States that we know, appears to be a kind of a sacred place. And I don't know if there's an energy about it, because you speak of Central and South America people migrating here. You've
European people, too.
Previous
European
people, that the Minoans and from perhaps the Romans came here. What is it about America that's the sacred, unique, cherished place that people migrate to? What do you think about that?
You're absolutely right. And I can quote you places that have been studied by professional archaeologists that are even national historic landmarks that the public doesn't know about, but they all say that. I mean, there's a site on Adisto Island, 4,200 years old architecture, major complex. Who built it? We don't know.
Where's that located?
On Adisto Island. It's a national historic landmark that even the people on Adisto Island doesn't even know it's there. It's architecture from 2200 BC. We have a temple site at a mud volcano in Metro Atlanta, Northeast Metro, called the Nota Rock. The temple was made out of carved stones. It has symbols on it, and it's identical to a type of temple built on Cyprus around 2200 to 2400 BC. You're right. I mean, there's so much more to the story. Our gripe, you know, as you, I think your introduction, I've worked with archaeologists in Mexico and with the National Park Service when I was living in Virginia, and in Sweden. I worked there for a while, and we had our, they're much more open. Their approach is they just can't get enough new knowledge. Our gripe right now is, as you say, there's this whole other story of America that no one's even asking the questions.
No.
And you're right. There's something about it, particularly certain parts of North America that attracted people from large, long distances. And I don't know what it is.
Yeah, it's like some kind of a energetic draw or magnetic. I don't know what it is.
We did a public television program with an international cast about a year after the History Channel. Probably it's in Spanish right now. I think it's being broadcast all over Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the casters are anthropologists from Latin America, but they set up equipment in the Nacuchi Valley, which is one of the sacred places of the Creeks, and they said there was gravitational waves there, that very strange things going on, as you have described in other places. So obviously, and this is where the Mayas first went also, same valley. There's something there that attracts people.
Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating. Well, listen, Richard, thank you very much for joining us. Now, your book, I wrote that it was recently written. It actually came out 2012. It's a Maya of North America, right? Was it 2012?
I wrote it when the archaeologists started trashing me, to be honest with you. I had no intention of getting involved in that, and I had to do something to get in writing our research.
Okay.
The book is of historic value. It explains how we came to that point. We're far beyond that, but our information is called It's a Maya of North America.
Right.
You can also download it for $15. But
okay.
Just understand it's obsolescent. We're our knowledge
you're
is
way
exploding.
Beyond that.
Way beyond there, yeah.
Yeah, and people of One Fire, again, listening audience, go check that out if you want to know about ancient Southwest United States, Georgia all the way to Florida.
Southeast.
Yeah, amazing.
We cover from Texas to Maryland. And basically the advanced cultures of the east of the Mississippi plus East Texas.
Wow. Well, what do you got on your plate now? I mean, this website's enough to keep anyone busy, but it sounds like you have your bunch of irons in the fires of movement towards more clarity on this.
Well, Dad, and I think I found the real location of Fort Carolyn, which would be America's oldest European fort, and there are archaeologists working on the Georgia coast now. It's not in Florida. And if they do find it, I guess I'll be involved with as an architect with the restoring it, you know. But that's other things on my plate right now.
That's pretty amazing. Go ahead.
What I do, I mean, I've also designed lots of new buildings, but what I do is I've been trained to take the drawings and the reports from the archaeologists and recreate what the structure looked like originally. That's what a historic preservation architect does. I got kind of specialized in the early colonial period when I was living in Virginia, you know, because a lot of the buildings there were quite old, and so I came back to Georgia, so I'm more specialized in the very, very earliest colonial buildings. And I guess I could do mounds too, but, you know. If they'll speak to right now, the archaeologists aren't speaking to me. But they're developing neck problems. They're turning their head 90 degrees so much they're going to have health problems pretty soon.
Oh, my God. We're going to have you back to talk about the Giants because you tipped off us with your 7-foot-tall human.
Okay, and keep in mind, we're not talking about mythology. It's just fact. I mean, okay.
We've had
documented
giant mound builders for a number of programs,
I'll give you a little hint. They came from these kings that were buried in these royal tombs that are 7 feet tall. They were called Paracousti, which is the name of the people who built the Nazca lines and also are the ones with the funny shaped skulls.
Oh, the
so our in, I mean, this is a document. The name of the high kings of the Creek people is the same name as the people with the weird skulls down in Paracus,
Paracas,
Nazca.
Peru. Yeah.
So our kings came from Western Peru, from that culture.
Amazing.
So now you got something to talk about, don't you?
There we go. We'll have to have you back on and talk about.
It's been
giants.
Fun. You're a nice guy.
Yeah. That's a book right there, Richard. I'll tell you, you got a hungry audience for anything related to giants and their TV shows. My guest today has been Richard Thornton, and our topic today was Maya in America, the untold story of ancient America. I really, really enjoyed our talk today, and much continued success. And
Thank you, sir.
Keep opening the eyes of the academic world, my friend.
Well, we're becoming the new academic. I'll be frank with you. We're going to start teaching courses from the people of fire. So we're just replacing them.
Right. Pleasure of speaking with you.
My pleasure, too.
Great. So that's it for today. And I want you to be aware of what's happening with Earth Ancients. We're trying to expand. We're moving to expand. And we will be expanding with our network. We've been given the green light, and we want you to help us do that. Become a member of Earth Ancients. And like I said, in the coming weeks, I will be announcing our program to help you become a member. And you can hear people like Richard Thornton and many, many, many others talk about a history that you don't read about. Have a great day.